I want to talk about a couple of problems. The first is I can't do it-ness, and the second is not enoughness. And both of these problems are mental creations. I think these problems are at the root of a lot of anger, frustration, sadness, and even depression. They reflect negatively on our freedoms, which is one of our needs. It also reflects negatively on usefulness, love, our identities, our need to be right, and the need to look good, get approval. And the futility of meeting our own needs means that our very survival is impacted. First of all, these beliefs, I can't do it, and not enoughness, I'm not enough, are false. Because they are widely held beliefs, they are very powerful in influencing our lives. In some cases, the most adventurous of us will attempt to do what we don't believe we can do, but more commonly, people don't even try to do what their beliefs tell them they cannot do. Oh, I can't do that. And they don't even start. They make no attempt. Even though beliefs are not necessarily true, we give them tremendous credibility, even to the point of death. We fail to recognize that beliefs are simply ideas that we repeat often enough so then we accept that they're valid. Just because we and others keep repeating them and repeating them. When I was a child, the kids in the neighborhood played a game. Its official name may have been Red Light or May I don't really recall. The goal was to advance to an established point, but you had to ask permission. May I? You could receive permission in the form of yes, you may, and if you asked can I, you were automatically rejected. Even today in conversations, you can hear the lack of differentiation between may I and can I. May I is about having permission to do something. Can I is about having the ability and the resources to do something. And there is a big difference between those two. It would be difficult for most people to grasp that they have to ask and receive permission from themselves, their ego, before even getting to the question of, can I? We need permission to consider new ideas. People raised in religiously fundamentalist families don't have permission to think for themselves. They are told what to think and what to believe. Thinking for oneself violates the key element of fundamentalism, obedience to dogma. I had a Jesuit priest tell me in a theology class in my third year of college that my job was to believe, not think. Well, that comment led me to stand up and start yelling at him for that absurdity. My classmates thought that would be my final day in school. But I lasted until the end of the semester. It was, however, my final day of being a Roman Catholic. Think, and you have my permission, of this sentence. I can't do it. How could you possibly know that statement to be true if you haven't tried to do it multiple times, adjusting your actions each time based upon the feedback you got from your attempts when you considered the effects of your action? If you limit your I in that sentence to the conscious mind you, you're probably right. That very limited you doesn't know how to grow, digest food, be nourished by the food that you digested, heal a physical or emotional wound, protect yourself via your immune system, and on and on. We have to accept that beliefs in this little I are false. There's no such thing except to the ego. The ego is the influence pointing out that you are alone and the only important one, and your needs are the only concerns. The ego, really important to life, its role is to protect and ensure your individuality. Think of all the ways that a person can try to motivate another person, yelling, screaming, threats, punishment, insults, soothing talk, encouragement, gentleness. In other words, carrots and sticks. The ego is the same type of motivator. It's kind of like a very harsh drill sergeant and a soft, caring person rolled into one. Because the ego is limited to only to think about the I of that singular individual, it can vacillate between weakness and limitation and an exaggerated sense of superiority. If you look at the four driving needs that concern the ego, you can see that the likelihood of the ego punishing the person for failing to achieve complete success in the accomplishment of these needs every time in every situation. It's just not going to happen. Even though we are compelled by ego to defend ourselves from criticism, emotional, and physical attack, you will notice the ego is the number one attacker of your beliefs, your behavior, your appearance, your being, your doing, and your having. And because the ego drives us to criticize and judge others and attack other people, we set the law of cause and effect in motion. We sow criticism and we reap criticism from others and from ourselves. Practicing criticizing is not a good habit. The ego is kind of like a guard at the border of our individuality, our identity. It is hyper alert to any kind of energy signal that could damage us. Because of its resistance to outside energies, except those it can take, manipulate, or dominate, being open to the influences of divine energies is questionable because the ego tends to be defensive. The ego thinks it's the only hope you have to be successful, and it will work tirelessly to drive you to its versions of success. And it will never be satisfied with what you achieve, no matter how much it is. In its effort to drive us, the tool most often used will be thoughts and feelings of not enoughness. There's a natural movement toward balance in life, and feelings of not enoughness are forms of imbalance. The urge to have more in the face of not enoughness, it's understandable. We want more comfort, more convenience, more gratification. We want more love, attention, money, power, family, friends, possessions, fame, influence, on and on. There's no end in sight unless we change our relationship with our ego. In the United States, we emphasize the myth of the self-made man who lifts himself up by his own bootstraps and against all odds and obstacles succeeds tremendously. This is a false story. Go find somebody who can lift himself up by his own bootstraps. He doesn't exist. Find somebody who claims to be a self-made success, and quickly you will notice a bunch of people surrounding him, helping. You'll see government programs being accessed and used, and all kinds of similar support systems that he used to create success. No one does it alone. For those who insist, "I did it alone," I would ask, is that true? Did you create all the infrastructure that you used? The roads, the telephone lines, electricity, the internet, the computers, the banking systems, the place that you actually worked, and the way you provided services or products? You did that all that by yourself? Of course they didn't. These systems are the reasons why so many people try to migrate to the United States, because we have the systems here that foster opportunity for everyone, including the non-existent self-made man. Let's move beyond another falsehood. I am alone. No one is alone. No one operates in life by themselves. Our most important bodily functions are controlled for us, not by us. A person may say, "I keep myself alive." For the most part, even that statement's false. A suicidal person may think they are about to kill themselves and only themselves, but even that is false. We may have the ability to harm our bodies, and millions of Americans do this every year to the point of physical death. But physical death is not death. It's only physical death. The soul of the person considering suicide isn't going to be killed, only the cells of their body. The source of life will continue its existence in the soul of the suicide. Quitting life, which is what suicide is, just means that that person, having quit, will be required to repeat life in order to learn the lessons that they signed up for in the first place. The ego may tell us we are alone, and only it can care for and protect us. If we believe this falsehood, then what should have been our assistant in life now becomes our master. Conflicts and false success can result from the ego being our master, but not elevation of our consciousnesses or true happiness and joy. I want to return to the image of the ocean of God. We are a point of consciousness in this ocean of consciousness. Everything exists in consciousness. All the help, health, ideas, success, love, caring, etc., we could possibly want exists in this ocean. And we can draw whatever we want to us through our thinking, our feeling, our speaking, and our acting. The thought, "I can't do it," is evidence of limited thinking. The potential in the ocean is available to each of us for the asking. That statement, "I can't do it," is not a report of a current condition. It's a command we give ourselves that shuts out divine resources that otherwise we would have access to. Try on this thought. "We can't do it," with the "we" being you and the power you call God. Would you even believe for a nanosecond that the power that creates universes and life doesn't have what you need and want to be healthy, happy, and successful? And if you believe that the power in itself is a figment of human imagination, you would have proven yourself to be too dull to notice the multitude of life forms expressing consciousness in their unique ways. You, even the singular I, have the power to create. You create by using your thoughts, feelings, words, and actions. You create by directing your will and purposes in the same path as your intention. You create positive structures by focusing your energies on what you want. And you create negative structures by focusing on what you do not want. Let's go back to the image of a point of consciousness in the ocean of consciousness. The potential everything exists in the ocean. We align our thinking, feeling, speaking, and acting, which draws consciousness to us. Our thinking, feeling, speaking, and acting sets up our energy field as a filter and a translator. The same life force we draw to ourselves to be used to create loving results is the same life force being drawn into the self by the next school shooter, although his filtering and translating are at primitive levels. That shooter's consciousness is evidence that devolution occurs. It is difficult to believe that not enoughness triggers, no pun intended, young men into killing innocent people in order to get attention. Not enough attention, not enough respect, not enough what? What have these men and boys done positively that warrants attention? Not enough, that's for sure. It is amazing that people who believe this about themselves make it about other people and then act out their self-hatred. The killers who kill school children are an example. So are those men who identify as incels, involuntarily celibate, who hate women for not wanting to have sex with them. Instead of asking, what is it about me that causes me to be unappealing or even repellent? They apparently don't do any self-assessment, but blame females instead. As I have mentioned many times, there seems to be an inbuilt urge to discover, can I do this? To have the first thought of insufficiency, but stop thinking and make that first thought the last thought, is to subvert the power to connect to the source of all power, the source of all can-do-itness. I wonder how much victimhood, as demonstrated by the shooters and the incels, is due to not holding themselves responsible for being productive, in positive terms, of what they really want. The human race has great impulses of love and building, although a toxic self-view certainly can lead to hatred and destruction. I see people who are overweight and unhappy about it. They don't take any action to remedy the situation, maybe because they think, I can't do it, or some other set of excuses. I wonder if two other ingredients are necessary for change to occur. Number one, does there need to be an unhappiness about being unhappy that becomes unacceptable? I'm not putting up with this anymore. I don't like these feelings. I'm going to do something about it. And number two, a clear image of what they don't want and or a clear, powerful image of what they do want. Maybe that's the way to get a person to change themselves. Because change is gradual, the will and the purpose to do it have to be maintained throughout the journey. Everyone wants instant gratification, but not many things of importance get built in a single day. When I first got out of the U.S. Army after 6 years, I looked for a job by reviewing the ads in the New York Times Sunday paper. There were about 1 million jobs listed, and the first time I looked at those ads, I didn't find a single one that I could do. Even though I was discouraged, I went back to those ads the next Sunday, and I found about 5 jobs that I could do out of those 1 million. The Sunday after that, I found about 100, and after that, 500. And pretty soon, I thought I might be able to do about 1 million of those jobs, and some of them required a little bit of training, like a weekend brush-up course in how to do brain surgery, and then I could be a brain surgeon. What happened? I was gradually shifting from a I-can't-do-it mindset to a can-I-do-it mindset. I believe this is what happens when we continue to seek what we want. If I accepted my first impression of not being able, I would have put down the newspaper on that first Sunday, and I would have been screwed. The situation I just described is why having a coach can be so helpful. The additional energy of another person reinforces the will to act. I saw a variation of this idea, and I found it really interesting, and it had to do with the creation of businesses when I was in Yellow Pages advertising. I noticed that I often had a conversation with two people who were about to start a business, and we would design ads or talk about them, and that became my job to design the ads and review them. Interesting, though, once the business got started, one of those people dropped away. They either decided not to pursue that line of business, or they became unnecessary in the activity. For whatever reason, they disappeared. And now, because the business must have needed two energies to start the momentum to propel it into manifestation, and once it got rolling, that second person was unnecessary. You could say the same thing is true of having a baby. At the beginning, two energies are necessary. But soon as fertilization has occurred, soon as pregnancy has happened, only one person is mandatory. The other person, not so much. I use the concept of the 10 emotional states to explain what usually happens when we embark on a new project, a new goal, or try to solve an existing problem. And I think maybe this, same with the starting a new business, we use somebody else's energy, you know, half my energy, half their energy. Oh, I feel like I can do it now because there were two of us adding 50%. But when we begin a new project or a goal or dealing with a problem, we may start at the lowest emotional state, shame. In this state, we look at ourselves and think, something's wrong with me. I'm defective. I'm defective for having these feelings of being overwhelmed or not being good enough, starting so late at this project. Why didn't I start this when I was a young person? If we stop there, we're screwed. The key is to realize that we can move through the first seven states. We can go from shame to apathy, to grief, to fear, to lust, to anger, to pride, and then we could hop up to the eighth, which is courageousness. And we can control the speed of that movement once we know what's happening and that these stages are natural and normal. And we're like, oh, I don't have to stay here feeling bad about myself. I can hop up. Oh, I don't have to be overwhelmed. I just need to get some more energy. Oh, I don't need to be looking over my shoulder at the things I lost by starting so late in life. And we keep moving upward. We don't need to be stuck in any one of these emotional states. All we have to do is recognize our feelings and then focus on moving ahead, moving upward. In Christ Returns reveals startling truth. The first characteristic provided to its creations by divine energy is that Christ saw was growth. Everything living grows. We're designed to grow. We're designed to grow spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. We grow our consciousness from a point of I can't do it-ness and not enoughness to having the awareness that we, the I, plus divine consciousness in harmony, can do it, and that not enoughness is the trick of the ego, driving us to greater physical efforts to ineffectively try to solve a consciousness problem. You may be able to imagine how frustrating these problems are for people when you realize and recognize that, number one, we are the creators of the problems that we have in our lives, not other people. Two, we keep that problem in place with our thinking. And three, we try all kinds of solutions that are unrelated to how we caused the problems in the first place. A problem in consciousness is not likely to be resolved with chemicals, alcohol, drugs, sex, surgery, money, etc. A problem in consciousness needs to be resolved in consciousness. Because energy moves, changes occur from one minute to the next. What is true or seems true at first may not be true or even seem true moments later. If we really understood this idea, we would accept that the initial feelings of I can't do it-ness and I am not enough are simply a common starting point of any new activity. Here's a scenario. A thought of an image comes to mind. We feel drawn to it somehow. Then the thought and the feeling, I can't do it, sweeps over and through us. Instead of quitting or running away or beating ourselves up because we just crashed into what we think might be a permanent fact about ourselves, we could know that these thoughts and feelings are needed in order for us to activate the impulse to energy acquisition. If that original thought or image were so mundane, so simple, we wouldn't have a need to be inspired to acquire energy. It's like, the need would have been ordinary, and so would our response have been ordinary. Every American male who watched cowboy movies as a kid understands the concept of the cavalry coming to the rescue of a besieged group of people, a wagon train, or a fort. it was always a great relief to hear, "Here comes the cavalry." And that is what will happen metaphorically if we can manage our emotions and our thoughts for just a little while after first fearing, "I can't do it. I am not enough." The divine support will rush to our aid if we think it, feel it, and believe it. As you listen to this prayer, you'll be able to hear the divine promise of support. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.